Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've sent me in the comments section below or by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. It's a new year. Here we are in 2016. Who would have thunk? Old look. So my book has been out for about a week, a little bit more than a week now, and sales look like they're doing pretty good, I think. But if you haven't seen the book trailer that I put out or heard anything about this, I talked about it last week, and also, of course, in my podcast, please do check it out and see what I put out there, because it's a very important piece to work, and I put a lot of time and effort into getting it right and putting out the information for you guys. And if you're here to, you know, find out about Scientology, then that book is definitely a must-have for you, because it answers so many questions, including everything about me and a very critical analysis of all aspects of Scientology. So without further ado, let's get into your questions for this week. Sammy Houtsinen. I might be wrong, but I think you said in one of your videos that sexuality, excluding homosexuality, isn't that big of a deal in Scientology. I finished Jenna Miscavige Hill's book today, and it really painted a picture of sexuality being a huge thing in Scientology, especially if you did out 2D or anything related to premarital sex, seemed to be a very bad thing. P.S. Is that Age of Empires on your computer desktop? Okay, well, there's a difference between sexual control and conduct in the Sea Org, the Sea Organization, versus regular public Scientologists or staff members. It's a whole different level of control. And I think when I was talking about this before, I was talking about it more from the aspect of the public Scientologist versus like in the Sea Org. Sexuality in the Sea Org is rigidly controlled, very tightly controlled. And you're going to find like anything having to do with any sexual activity is totally verboten unless you're married. So any premarital sexual activity, anything like that they could be construed as heavy petting would be, you know, no good. And you get in a lot of trouble if you do something that is considered, you know, a violation of that, and that's what's called out 2D. In Scientology, the second dynamic, or 2D, is a term used to describe all sexual activity, sexual function, family, the family unit, having kids, all of that is encompassed by this term they call the second dynamic. So out 2D means violating the rules of the second dynamic or doing something that is not prescribed behavior according to Scientology rules and regulations, especially in the Sea Org, where they have those rules and regulations. Outside of the Sea Org, they don't have those rules the same way. You know, it becomes a cultural thing, you know, sort of a group agreement as to what is or isn't okay. You know, obviously adultery is not okay. But masturbation amongst, you know, in the Scientology public world is not as big of a crime or as big of a problem as in the Sea Organization, where masturbation is absolutely not acceptable behavior at all, and you can get in a lot of trouble if they catch you or find out that you have been, you know, doing anything like that, much less if you go extramarital or anything, or premarital, anything, you know. And the attitude is very conservative, very sort of 1950s, sort of a, I described it as a sort of a leave it to beaver attitude, you know, very like, you know, they're not into, you know, in the Sea Organization, if you are having like wild, crazy sex with your wife and it's noisy or something, you know, you're going to hear about it from everybody. They're going to write knowledge reports on you, and you're going to be seeing the ethics officers like, dude, you know, it's not, no. Because you're not supposed to. Here's the whole thing on it, okay? I mean, all of that's very interesting, but in the Sea Organization, the whole reason for all of that is because you're not supposed to have your attention on anything other than clearing the planet and doing the job. And the job and the group are everything, and everything else takes a back seat to that, including your wife or your husband, And of course, when you're in the Sea Org, you can't have kids. So it's kind of like, instead of looking at this from the viewpoint of all these rules and regulations, instead, if you really want to get the right idea of how the Sea Org approaches this, look at it from the point of view that anything going on in a person's life other than doing their job is not unimportant. You know what they call it having other fish to fry is an old expression. You know, you have other fish to fry means you've got something else that you think is more important than what you're supposed to be considering important. And that's how the Sea Org deals with sex and anything having to do with sex. And they also consider that it is somewhat mentally what they call restimulative. In other words, it you know, you start thinking about sex or engaging in sex or sexual activity, and it stirs up all these pictures and you know, can kind of be very distractive to you, and again goes back to not being able to do your job. So that's kind of the simplest explanation I can give for the attitude towards sex and sexuality in the Sea Org. And yes, that is an Age of Empires game on my computer. Helen, love your YouTube channel. I see some similarity in your situation and being abused by narcissists. I wonder how you have come to forgive the fraud and abuse you suffered. How have you come to forgive? All right, well, I'm going to be totally straight with you. When it comes to run-of-the-mill Sea Org or run-of-the-mill Scientologist or something, I got nothing on those people, because I've learned enough to understand that most of the people who are in the bubble world of Scientology are there under undue influence. They have been tricked, lied to, deceived, conned, you know, whatever word you want to use, in order to get their mind around the idea that what they're doing is the greatest good for the greatest number. It's the best thing they could possibly be doing, and they think they're saving the world. And, you know, how do you fault somebody for that? How do you fault somebody for doing, you know, extraordinary things, you know, maybe sometimes extraordinarily bad things, you know, under the misbegotten notion that they are saving the world, you know, or saving lives? You know, it's you can justify a lot of stuff with that. And I understand that because of the false pretenses and the lies and the ignorance that they live under, that they really don't quite understand or get what they're doing, you know. Now, that's run-of-the-mill people, right? So my friends, you know, the people that I used to know, the kind of stuff we used to get into, you know, I had lots of fights with people, and I had lots of situations where I was you know, put in a tough situation by senior people who, you know, were giving me orders or directions or whatnot to do things that were not a lot of fun to do. And I you know, I had some rough spots, you know, some physical degradation and, you know, a lot of emotional and mental degradation and stuff. But I don't blame them individually for that, because you can tell the difference between when they're doing that because they think they're doing some good versus, you know, sort of, you know, whetting their sadistic appetites upon you, right? And when it comes to that, to be honest, I haven't forgiven those people. Now, that's a small group of people. That's a very, very small group of people. In fact, I think I could probably count on one hand those people. And I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to forgive those people. I'm talking about the folks who were responsible for disconnecting me from my ex-fiance and my whole life, right, by declaring me a suppressive person. Like the people directly responsible for that, because I know exactly who they are. And, you know, those people don't get a pass from me, you know, because that was really pretty nasty what they did. And they didn't do it because they thought they were saving the world. They're in a different position. The guys who are in, you know, the higher ups in the Office of Special Affairs, for example, are well aware of, you know, the world view of Scientology and the actual backstory of what goes on behind the scenes, you know, and I'm talking about like upper level people. So they're not necessarily aware of the full picture. They're not aware of the whole con and the money and all that sort of thing. I don't think they know everything, because I don't think they'd continue to be part of it if they thought they were part of some big long con on the part of L. Ron Hubbard. They still believe in Scientology itself, but they, you know, you only can get so far with this, you know, when you're you know, ruining people's lives, and you're doing it on purpose, and you know you're doing that. That's a whole nother thing. So, like I said, there's a couple people. You know, it's not a lot, and I'd have to really, I don't know if I'm ever going to forgive those folks. So, you know, I think with a lot of understanding, a lot of education, a lot of recovery that I've gone through, has enabled me to have a much more forgiving attitude and, you know, that sort of thing. And of course, obviously, you know, I get to look in a mirror when it comes to having done bad things to people, because I did plenty of bad things to people. You know, I never fair gamed anybody, and I never, you know, enforced disconnection on anybody that I'm aware of, but I did plenty of, you know, maltreatment and mistreatment of people below me and yelling and screaming and all that sort of thing. So, you know, that also, you look at that and you go, how much of this can I really hold up against people when, you know, I was doing it too? So I think that's kind of how I look at it now. And I think 99.5% of the people that I've ever known or had anything to do with in Scientology, I would welcome with open arms if they came out now. Buckluster. Please explain the extraordinary work ethic that is apparently instilled in every Scientologist. Surely such a character trait is to a large degree an issue of temperament. Does Scientology somehow overcome this? Or perhaps lazy people simply don't last long in Scientology? Does this issue somehow relate to the Scientology ethos of helping the able to be more able and screw everybody else? Is that a fair characterization? Well, again, I think you're talking mostly about the Sea Org versus your regular run-of-the-mill Scientologists, because your regular public Scientologist and even most staff aren't really that hard of workers. I mean, the staff more so, you know, sometimes the staff really go the extra mile, but, you know, but they go home at night. They, you know, that sort of thing. They have, you know, they have regular jobs because of the duty and that sort of thing, and they put in a lot of extra time. So don't get me wrong. I don't mean to put them down, but it's a whole nother level when you get to the Sea Org, and I think that's what I'm looking at in a comparison. Is as hard as you work as a Scientology staff member, and you do that for duty, you do that because you think it's the right thing to do, you think that being in Scientology and working that hard, hours-wise, at least the number of hours you're working, is you're doing that because it really is for a greater purpose. And it's kind of like that, again, only kind of on steroids when you get into the Sea Org. And it is true that people do come in from various temperaments, to various levels of ability to work. And if you're just kind of a naturally lazy person or have a tendency to slack off a lot, you're not going to make it in the Sea Org. They sort of weed those people out when they're still in the boot camp process on the EPF, the Estates Project Force. That's kind of what that's there for, is to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, you know. And so, you know, generally, if somebody doesn't want to work hard, you know, you can't get through the EPF if you're not willing to run and work and scrub and take orders and deal with a lot of nonsense, you know. I guess similarly to a military boot camp. Then when you get done with that, that's just the beginning. You know, boot camp is rough, as I understand it. Now, I, of course, have never been in the military, so if I'm getting this wrong, I'm just talking from my understanding of it and what I've seen in movies and heard from friends and family who were in. So, as I understand it, once you're through boot camp, things get a lot chiller in the military. You know, it's not as rough anymore. I mean, unless, of course, you get into combat or something. Of course, that's a whole nother thing. In the Sea Org, the point I'm making is that once you're done with the EPF or their version of boot camp, you then go and start working. It gets rougher. Like, the hours are longer. The work is more demanding. The screaming and yelling is much more intense. And the punishments are way more intense, right? You can find yourself, you know, within a couple of days, if you say the wrong thing to the wrong person or darn not getting your job done, you can find yourself up till 2 or 3 in the morning scrubbing pots in the galley. and, you know, good luck on getting any sleep that night, right? Or you could be up, you know, again, sleep deprivation for any doing any number of things, right? The physical sort of punishments and whatnot can, you know, they get pretty creative with that stuff. So all of that could be going on within days of you finishing your EPF in the Sea Org. So it's definitely expected that you will be working really hard. And if you're not, then you're going to have to go through these punishments until you get your butt in gear and start going, is sort of the, you know, mindset there. And if that's something that's intolerable to a person and they lose the purpose or the drive or whatever, or they don't want to be there anymore because they think it's all a bunch of crap, then they, you know, what they call hit, they go on decks, they go on the decks, they hit the decks, meaning they are asking to leave, and they have to go through that whole process, right? Which took me like 9 months to go through. But you go through that process and then they let you go, right? Or, of course, people just blow, they leave, they just take off. And if you do that, well, you're not going to be doing any more Scientology for the rest of your life. So that's sort of the options that you have there. So basically, you know, I think that work ethic that gets instilled in people, if they, you know, if they feel that duty and that drive to do this thing, to do the Scientology thing and clear the planet, then they just kind of get used to working real hard all the time and not having any privacy and not really having any, you know, a whole lot of personal time. And like I said in that earlier answer, kind of putting everything else aside, you know, everything else is less important. Family, sex, friends, like all that. Put it to the side because that's other fish. It's other fish to fry. You got other fish to fry. And in the Sea Org, you don't get away with having other fish to fry. Kiva Go. Hi, Chris. Still loving your channel. Can you take us through a typical emergency or dealing with a flap when you were in the Sea Org as far as the extra time, stress, pressure put on you? How frequent were these on average? Also, your thoughts on the IRS revoking the tax-exempt status of the World Literacy Crusade front group this year. Can we expect that to happen to more tax-exempt CFS front groups? When I was in the Sea Org, my entire life was an emergency or flap. There was always some emergency or some flap going on. And I do mean that, like, quite literally. Always. Always. So it's kind of hard to describe. I mean, so describing what, you know, that is like is kind of like describing what it's like to be in the Sea Org. Because it's kept that way on purpose. Things are always kept in this crazy hamster wheel speed, you know, like zzz, sort of, but, you know, mode, so that the people who are there in that group don't get a chance to stop and rest and think. It's done on, you know, that's why that's done. And it comes from the top. It comes from the very top. There's always something being pushed down the line, you know, from the command channels or from RTC, you know, coming in, you know, from the side, from the Commodore's Messenger Org and RTC, you know, that has to be handled right now, right now, right now. And it could take anywhere from, you know, let's say you had some emergency, like you have to, like as a manager for the Western United States, I would get this thing where this one particular organization had to send, every organization had to send two people for training to Clearwater, to Flag in Florida. And they had to be qualified to go, and then they had to go full time to Flag and do the training and then come back home. This happened many, many times over the years that I was in, where we had to send trainees for some new thing, some new release, some new course or service that was going to be delivered, and they needed to be trained on it. And they, of course, the only place they could be trained on it all at one time was at Flag. And so Flag has qualifications. You can't send just anybody. And so now you have to send these orders down, and every organization from Albuquerque to Hawaii to Los Angeles has to send these two people. So you send orders down the line, you know, now, get these people sent, right? And I want to know who their names are and are they qualified, and get the whole form, you know, there's a whole application form that needs to be filled out for them, and and it's very involved. And so they got to select two staff members that they can just take and send a flag. And they have to go through this whole process, and we're having to push them because every single day that it's that those trainees are not sent is a flap for us, is a problem, right? And we're not making it happen. And so we're the ones who are getting in trouble. And then we're trying to push that pressure down the line through telexes, right? Because you can't just pick up a phone and call. But of course, you know, when the pressure gets high enough, we start calling. And we're not supposed to. They know we're not supposed to be calling at the org level, at the church level. But we are anyway, because it's a huge emergency. And what do you mean you haven't sent this guy yet, right? And all this. And then if they still don't make it work, like Albuquerque, you know, it's got like five staff members, right? There's like no, there's nothing there. So how are they going to possibly send two people, and they can't figure it out, and they don't do it. So we, you know, end up having to send maybe me and one other person to Albuquerque to figure out who's going to go or recruit new staff members specifically to send them to Flag for training. This whole thing probably sounds completely ridiculous, but this was intensely consuming of time and energy and resources. Over and over and over again, this happened while I was in management. They have personnel demands just up one side and down the other. So, so what I'm describing to you was not a one-time, you know, one-off sort of deal. This happened all the time. There might be other kind of flaps, like a church, you know, an org like Albuquerque didn't pay their rent for like 5 months. So now they're about to be evicted. And we got to figure out, you know, we got to push them and figure out how to get them to make that much money to pay their rent. And if they don't pay it, we got to pay it. Now, not, I don't mean out of our pockets. I mean, at the management level, the management organization has to pay. And if we have to pay, there's going to be hell to pay, right? So this whole thing goes on, right? And these are just a couple examples of the kind of flaps that and emergencies that would come across my plate every other week, you know, so... So that's kind of how that went. As far as giving you a twofer here, you know, I don't know about tax exempt, you know, front groups. I hope they all lose their tax exempt status. That'd be great, you know, because it would be a domino effect to lead back to the church. But you know, it's a big subject, lots and lots of front groups. So I'm not going to really address that whole subject, you know, here and now. Flash answers. William Travel. It seems that many ex-cult members become somewhat vaccinated against normal bullshit too and don't fall into the smaller traps of the normal world as brand fanboyism and tabloid journalism. Is this a fair observation, and is this one of the many real wins of your new life? No, I haven't really observed that to be true. I've seen lots and lots of people who come out of Scientology and are still very much in a sort of a non-critical thinking mindset. So I wouldn't say that that's true or a fair observation. I think that there are some who come out. You know, it just happened that I stumbled on critical thinking as a subject. And I of course would like to say I'm not a, you know, I've never been a moron, but I didn't know what critical thinking was or skepticism. I just didn't know. And finding out helped me a lot, and I learned all about that. And so that's what's helped me to, you know, not necessarily get into certain pitfalls that other people might get into or get involved in. As far as, you know, as far as fanboyism or tabloid journalism or something, I guess the bullshit meter might be a little bit set a bit higher on people who come out of cults. That's probably true. That's probably a fair observation as far as that goes. But you know, there are many, many exceptions to that. I've seen so many people come out of Scientology still drinking the Kool-Aid when it comes to conspiracy theories and some pretty ridiculous things that, you know, alternative health stuff and things like that. I've still seen a lot of that. So I can't say that it's a universal thing. I think it's individual for each person. George Bosloff. I understand that David Miscavige is now addressing himself as the Pope of Scientology. On your last question about Tom Cruise left me with a quick question. Do you think it is possible that Cruise will ever join the Sea Org? as a rank of full commander and be named Miscavige's heir apparent. It could make sense that Miscavige could be made Sea Org Captain Emeritus, i.e. Benedict as Pope Emeritus, and Tom then replace him as the Sea Org's full captain. What are your thoughts? No, I don't think any such thing is ever going to happen. Tom Cruise is a celebrity. In fact, he's one of the highest paid, most famous celebrities on the planet. And the last thing that David Miscavige wants, or Tom Cruise wants, is for him to stop doing that. They want him to continue being the most famous person or one of the most famous people in the world. And if there's anything that's wanted from Tom Cruise, it's that he start talking about Scientology again. Because he's, you know, shut the hell up about that for the last many years, since there was such negative PR ramifications to him and the way he was doing that. But I'm quite sure that that is what is wanted of Tom Cruise. And I don't see any scenario where he joins the Sea Org and takes over for David Miscavige. That's not a very realistic scenario. Renewed calm. In that great Tom Cruise video in which he claims that only he, as a Scientologist, could help at a traffic accident scene, what exactly do you think he thinks he could do to help that a regular person couldn't? Call Miscavige and tell him to get his people to handle it? Probably. You know, Scientologists delude themselves quite intensely as to the level of help they provide to people or situations. You know, some of them have logistic skills or organizing type skills, but Tom Cruise is, you know, these guys, it's, what does he think he could do? I don't know, assists, touch assists, nerve assists. I think he probably has a higher assessment of his own abilities than are warranted, that he could like organize things or get things under control or direct people as to what to do. You know, that kind of nonsense, because he doesn't know anything about how to deal with an accident scene or a crime scene or something like that. They just trump themselves up on their own importance, and that's all Tom Cruise is really doing there. Dick's Gun. I don't understand the concept of the empty orgs. What do you suppose the ultimate goal is for them? Well, quite simply, I think it has to do with equity and credit and property value. And that is the value that those big empty buildings have for Scientology internationally, is it gives it credit standing and you know, this apparency of expansion and, you know, good news of getting bigger and that sort of thing, because they look at the great big buildings, you know, is sort of how that serves Miscavige and his ongoing, you know, deceit machine. And telling Scientologists how Scientology is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Jesus Fish. Hey Chris, I have a question about pay. I know the Sea Org are paid very little, but I am curious about other areas of the church. I understand that some of the for-profit areas of Scientology are paid more. Also, how about the executives in OSA? What sort of remuneration and perks do they receive? Try none. Every single person in OSA, at least at a continental and international level, are Sea Org members. That means they're getting paid at most $50 a week. Same with any other executive in Scientology other than David Miscavige. These people are not getting any money, and I'm not quite sure what you mean by the for-profit areas of Scientology, because there aren't really any for-profit areas of Scientology in terms of, you know, any of them being, you know, they're classified as not-for-profit, they're classified as tax-exempt churches. So I guess maybe you might refer to the front groups, you know, the non-church secular groups. I don't know. They don't get paid a lot, you know, not really. You have companies of people who are Scientologists, who are members of the WISE business groups. You know, that's not church. That's a whole different thing. So they're paid by their companies. So that's a whole different thing than being paid by the church. If somebody is, you know, you have this big conglomeration of organizations called the Church of Scientology, and within that group, nobody's getting paid, period, except the guy at the very top. So that's kind of the answer to that. All right, and so we've come to the end of another episode of our critical Q&A. It seemed to go pretty fast. I had a lot of questions there, and I hope you got something out of the answers that I gave. I will put links up now to where you can get my book. So if you haven't checked it out, please do so. And I think you'll get a lot of any, you know, questions that you have about Scientology answered simply by reading that. So I look forward to any other questions or comments you have. Please don't hesitate to leave them for me in the comments section below. And I look forward to seeing y'all next week.